you didn't have a pulse. You were dead. I don't know what we were laughing at, but we were laughing. Okay. And I know that he comes from dark secrets too, and we share a common illness. But I also know that we share a common recovery. So I'd like to hear the rest of his story. Please wake Ken from Casa Mesa, California.
So we'll close in the usual way. And holy jeez, you guys in Atlanta have a lot of warm up here. Yeah. I mean, I felt like I was in night court waiting for my case to be called. I mean, this is My name is Ken, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Good to see your smiling faces. You look like a holding tank kind of crowd, you know, like this is it. This is good here. It's always nice to stand behind one of these things and not have to enter a plea. It's this is good stuff. I want to thank Mike and Tony and all the folks on the committee for inviting me to come out and speak. I want to thank Owen and his wife Peggy for generously picking us up at the airport and extending their generosity to us over the last few days. We've had a lot of laughs. You know, laughter's a good thing. You know, I don't know about all this anger and stuff. I personally was always serene, you know, so I have a tough time with all that stuff. You know, I noticed, just to take in the surroundings I'm in, because I always had some survival skills as a street kid. And whoever put the stage together, Sally, whoever was responsible for that, thank you very much. You have 12 blocks for each step and each tradition. I like that. So that's good. I feel like I'm on terra firma because I'm standing right in the middle of the steps and the traditions. And depending on how you count, I'm either in the fourth or the fifth step or the eighth or the ninth. Either way, I'm happy with them. And I want to thank whoever did the sign up there, because the sign is great. You know, we have these three panels. We couldn't get the triangle, so we couldn't have Unity Recovery and Service, so we just used these three panels, which they were nice enough to stand out from the wall. And we put Trust God over here for Unity. We put Clean House for Recovery and Help Others for Service. So that's really good stuff. You guys are on the ball here in Atlanta. You know, really on the ball. You know? And that's from a guy who got through school totally unscarred by education. You know, like, this is good. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm a real alcoholic. You know, if you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, they talks about being a real alcoholic. And that means I drank stuff that not only hit the spot, but it removed it. You know, like, that's just basically the way it happened. You know? I was one of these guys that always had a lot going on in my mind. I heard things differently than other people. When I was eligible to vote, the first time I was eligible to vote, Kennedy was running for president. And I was in a bar, which was very unusual at that time. And the name of the bar was an Irish bar, Fitzgerald's. And the guy said to me, "Who are you voting for?" One of those intellectuals I hung out with. And I said, "I'm voting for Kennedy." And he said, "Oh, I know why you're voting for Kennedy." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because he's Irish Catholic." And I said, "No, asshole. I'm voting for him because I'm Irish Catholic." You know? So I heard things a little differently than other people, you know? And the deal is that if you're a real alcoholic of my type, you know, even when you were arrested, you know, when you were arrested, I know this never happened to you guys, but when you were arrested, the first thing they would tell you is, you have the right to remain silent. I personally never had the ability, you know. I always both with some explanation, we could put this to rest, you know, like that. Let me just explain how my foot got in his chest. It was, you know, he questioned my ancestry, and I took a little issue with it, you know. Like, so I was just that kind of a guy, you know. And somebody said the other day at one of the meetings I was at, they said, you know, I come from a family where you're either in AA or you need it. You know, there's no, you know. My mom used to say the only time we said no to a drink is if we misunderstood the question, you know? You know? My mom used to hold up cans of beers, Wrangell and Schaefer in particular, and she'd read the label and say, I don't know what's in here that makes you act so stupid, you know? And if you're a real alcoholic, real alcoholics like me like to play Russian roulette with a bullet in every chamber. And then we're totally surprised by the bang. Boom. And we immediately try to blame someone else. And then it's brought to our attention, you loaded the gun. You know, like... And that was the way life always was with me. I was always loading the gun, you know. And so I was ripe for Alcoholics Anonymous. I was really, really ripe. You know, I went to, as Owen pointed out, I went to a parochial school for a while and then just didn't finish there. And then I went to a public school. But it seemed like no matter where I went, the teachers always had a tough time understanding what I was trying to communicate, you know. I would have ideas that were strictly my own. In high school, I was court ordered to a psychiatrist, and I had some anger issues. And I went to the psychiatrist, and he asked me, he said, what are you thinking about right now? And I made something up. And he said, that's not what you're thinking about. What are you thinking about right now? And I made something else up. And he said, you have to tell me what you're thinking about right now. And right at that moment, I was thinking, if my knees bent the other way, what would chairs look like, you know? And I hadn't met you guys yet. I intuitively knew that I didn't want to tell them what was going on, you know? Otherwise, you might have a whole different speaker tonight. That, you know, that's for sure. And I ended up living with my mom in a senior citizen home just before I came into AA. And I got a letter from the, or she got a letter saying that, you know, I wasn't a senior citizen. But I had been there so long, I could use the walker. You know, like I was beginning to look really senior, you know. And so I had to move out of there. You know, I just had to get out of there. And before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it just seemed like nothing in my life was going just the way it should go. Now, I mentioned that I got through school totally unscarred by education. And I hung out with guys who were just like me. All of their names began with A Tony, a Vinny, a Nicky. You know? I mean, we were the kind of guys you say, there's a dead bird, we look up, you know. It's just that's who we were. You know? People used to say, how far is it to the subway? We said, we don't know, no one's ever made it, you know, like, you know. Well, my personal favorite, he fell asleep in the trunk of a car, he deserved to be shot. You know, like, it was that kind of a neighborhood. People used to find stuff before other people officially lost it, you know? Everything in the neighborhood was on the move, you know? My dad died when I was young, and my mom, God love her, she knew there was something going on with me. She knew I was no day at the beach, you know? And she would walk through the living room, and if I was thinking, she'd say, turn on the television right away. You know? And we had a little 12-inch Admiral. Remember when they had those little 12-inch Admirals? And we had a piece of green paper and a piece of purple paper, and we put it over because that would give us color, you know. And mosquitoes would get caught in behind it. You didn't know if the mosquito was a creature in the movie or something they had to swat, you know. So, and everything in the neighborhood was the same way, you know. Everybody around the neighborhood was doing the same stuff. It was like universal theft. It was like there was like everybody was into the action. And so I just started drinking. At that time you could drink in New York at 18. I started going to the bar where my brother was a bartender. I was about 12 or 13. And I used to just sit there and have a couple of beers and play cards with the guys. And then go home. You know, that was and I didn't get in any trouble for a couple of years doing that. And then what happened was I crossed over that invisible line. And then I began to do all the things that crazy people do. I mean, I was insane, you know. Guys didn't want to fight with me, not because I was tough, but I didn't know how to lose gracefully, you know. They'd have to beat me to death, you know, like. And then I keep saying, like, you know, it's almost like Monty Python movie. King, come on back here, you know. And then you were always explaining stuff to people. You know, you'd go in the bar and you'd get a barroom facial from someone, and you'd be at the emergency room at 2 o'clock in the morning, and some very, very nice nurse who had to work the night shift because her kids went to school during the day is trying to be helpful, and she'd say things while she's stitching you up like, how did this happen? And you'd say things like, I went in the bathroom. And when I came back, he was sitting in my chair. I tried to ask him not to move, you know? And then when you couldn't communicate with somebody, you know, you kind of just introduced them to a bottle or something. So it was always a lot of, you know, it was always a lot of movement in my life. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, when I ended up coming here, my sobriety date is July 5th of 1970. Wow. And when I came here, you know, to Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to a meeting in Brooklyn, and it was the 5th of July, and I showed up in a blue wool suit. I had a shirt and tie because I thought, well, you know, we'll take a peek, see what's going on. And I walked down the step, and of course, one of you with a real, hi, you know. Newcomer, you know, like, how did they know, you know? My eye was swollen up, my lip was busted, and I was wearing a blue wool suit. And I remember, he's so smiley, he said, come up front, that's where the miracle takes place. Oh. You can tell I'm ecstatic about the miracle, you know, like, oh, yeah, I don't want to miss the miracle, you know. So I went up front, and then after the meeting, they say, we're going over to diner. Why don't you come with us? So at that time, I had no particular place to go. So I went with these lessers. And we went into the diner, and they had one booth in there that was like a half-moon booth. And they always got the newcomer to go in first. Big mistake. Big, big mistake. Because once you were in, you weren't getting out till everybody went home. So I got on the inside, and there I was, a priest, two plumbers, a lawyer, and a guy from the FBI. And I'm thinking, this is what it's come down to. You know, like that. One guy I'm confessing to, the other guy I think is going to help me out, and the other guys are always looking for me. So now we're having coffee in the diner, you know. And the one guy who was a plumber said, I'm going to be your temporary sponsor. And he died last year, so he was my temporary sponsor for 37 years, you know. And trust me, he needed the work, you know. You know, my wife and kids had moved out of state because they were trying to maintain their sanity. And I was living with my mom, and he used to say, you know, come over to my house and we'll have dinner and then we'll go to a meeting. So I'd go over to his house every night, and then we'd have dinner and we'd go to a meeting. And he knew if I was left alone very long, some bad things were going to happen to me. Now, he had, in 1970, he had bought one of the first 9-passenger station wagons. And of those of you who don't remember, the back seat faced out the back. Me and Fast Eddie always had to sit in the back seat. I quizzed him about this several times. Why do Fast Eddie and I always have to sit in the back seat? And he smoked the worst cigars you could possibly smoke. I think he bought a dozen for a nickel, you know? And you had to see this guy. He had a head that looked like it had already worn out 2 bodies. You know, like, and he had a twitch from his fighting days. So he'd be puffing and twitching. And he'd be telling you, if you want what I have. You know? And I wanted it, you know? That's a sad thing. So I always sat in the back, and we go to the meetings, and so one night I'm over there and the phone rings, and he gets off the phone and he said, we got a 12-step call. I said, good. I had no idea what a 12-step call was. But he was excited, so I was excited. And at that time, I had been with him long enough, I think I was twitching myself, you know? I was just getting the twitch down. I didn't smoke, but I had the twitch pretty good. So I said, let's go, you know? Let's get going here. So we went out to the car, and I headed for the back, and he said, whoa, sit up front. And I said, hey, hey. Hey, hey. This thing's starting to pay off after a month, you know? So I get in the front seat and we go to this brownstone, and of course there's no parking. So he says to me, Ken, can you get this guy? And I looked at him. I said, yeah, I can get this guy. He said, no, 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 this is serious. Can you get this guy? And I said, yeah, I can get this guy. I said, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not remedial. You know, like, you know, I can go and ring the bell and, you know, get the guy. So he says, go get him. I'm going to drive around the block and I'll come pick you up. So as he tells the story, he drives around the block. And when he pulls up, I have the guy on the ground. And I'm beating him with a garbage can lid. Sometime between the time he called and we arrived, he had what is called a change of heart. You know? Which I have since found out he was entitled to, you know? But this was my first AA job. I wanted to get off to a good start, you know? So I have him on the ground, and I don't want to make this sound excessive. I hit him maybe 2, 3, 4, no more than 4 times, you know? And I could tell this guy was willing to turn his will and his life over to me. After the second shot, he was like, and I'm going, you son of a man. So my sponsor, being a very good AA member, whistled me to the car like I was a canine. So I knew I was in trouble because the twitch was now very noticeable. And I get in the car, and we start down the avenue. He's almost choking on this cheap cigar. I mean, there's enough smoke there, we're starting to attract Indians, you know? Like, it's like smoke all over the place. I'm opening every window, vent, you know? Hey, you know, like, I'd like to make it for 90 days, you know? So he said, I want you to do me two favors. I said, sure, what are they? He said, number one, never consider that a 12-step call. And then he said, number two, don't tell anybody I'm your sponsor for a while. You know? I'd like to see how it goes, you know? So we kept going to meetings and doing this stuff, and it seemed like no matter where I went, they knew I was a newcomer. And then I realized one night, after about 2 months, that I had a red name tag with Ken on it, and everybody else had a blue name tag. So after the meeting, I went up to the secretary. I said, hey, yo, how come I have a red name tag and everybody else has a blue name tag? And he said, you're ready for a blue one, Ken. So he rips the blue, the red one off, and he puts the blue one on. And of course, I'm walking back to the back of the room, and I'm thinking to myself, you know what? You just can't slip too much past me. You know? You know, it only took me 2 months to pick up on this. And then he and I got into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we started to take the steps just the way they're done in the big book. We didn't have any extra ancillary products. We didn't go to seminars. We just did the 12 steps exactly the way they were in the big book. And as we went through those 12 steps, I was evicted from my hiding places. All of my life, I had been hiding from who I really was. And as I went through those steps, I got evicted. And I began to realize that there was a lot more going on here than garbage can lids. You know, I began to realize that something was happening in my life that had never happened before. And that is, I was starting to sleep nights a little bit better. And I actually had feelings of joy in the morning. You know, I began to notice that life was worth living. And so I started doing all this stuff. Now, I hung out with guys that you had to see these guys to believe them, you know. They as I said this morning, they hung out there where the buses don't run, you know. They would have conversations, and you'd wonder, like, what is going on with this guy? I actually heard one of the guys say to another guy, you know, Nicky, if your mother didn't have any children, there's a good chance you won't. These are the kind of guys, you know. Guys would say to you, you know what, I read I'm only using 6% of my brain. What am I doing with the other 40%? You know? You know? So when you hang out with people who are totally insane, your own insanity goes unnoticed. You know, I was... I was beginning to look like I was the chief, you know? And the deal was, as we did these meetings together, and you know what? These guys were staying sober. And they were staying sober because one thing they picked up early on in the game was you did service work. You did things. You know, you set up chairs and you do stuff. I learned a lot about commitment. I know people who kept commitments. You know, when I got sober, just to show you where I was, I got sober in 70, July, and Bill Wilson died January the 24th of 71. So I was sober a little over 6 months when Bill died. And in New York, they broke his anonymity in all the papers, which was already, you know, set up to do. I read the paper, the headline, co-founder of AA dies. So I called my sponsor, and I said, geez, this is tough. He said, what? I said, the owner died. I said, does that mean they're going to have any more meetings or what now? You know, so he said, Sparky, you just keep coming, you know. You keep coming to the meetings, D. You're going to be just fine, you know. But that's where I was at. But we had a guy in Brooklyn, Joe B. And Joe B. used to, he got sober in 67 and he met Bill Wilson and he loved Bill Wilson. And when Bill Wilson died on the 24th of January, it was a Saturday, I believe, and then they decided a couple of weeks out they were going to have a memorial service for him at St. John the Divine in New York City. And it was decided that at that time, all over the country and all over the world, memorial services would be held for Bill Wilson at the same time. And Joe B. had a commitment in Brooklyn at 2 o'clock on Sunday. And he wanted to be at St. John the Divine at 3:30 to see and be part of this memorial service for Bill. But he kept his commitment, and he went and he set up the chairs. And he used to say he prayed that nobody showed up. So he set up the chairs, and he started the coffee, and he kind of just hung out there. And it got to be 2 o'clock, and no one was there. So he started to fold the chairs. And about 2:10, he heard footsteps coming down the stairs. And a guy stuck his head in and said, is this where you come to get sober? And Joe B. said, I said, you bet it is. I'm just plugging in the coffee. Come on in and have a cup. See, that's the kind of people that keep commitments. It's doing something sometimes long after you've lost the desire to do it. You know, Bill was sharing the other night very elegantly about commitment. You know, I go to a meeting on Saturday in my area where I have the least sobriety of about 10 or 12 guys that sit together. You know, I'm the youngest one, so when they want coffee, I get the coffee. I'm 38 years sober, and I'm fetching. And so, and those guys come there consistently, and they all keep their commitments, and you get to see them keep their commitments. We used to be called the Serenity Section, and now we're called Intensive Care. I mean, as we're getting older, somebody's always in the hospital, you know, like, where's so-and-so? Hey, he had this done, you know. And so the whole deal is that you learn a lot about commitment. And, you know, in AA, people try to figure out way too much stuff. You know, if you look in the owner's manual, the big book, you're gonna see a lot of chapters, but there's no chapter there into thinking. The last thing you want is an alcoholic to be thinking, you know? It's like carrying gasoline into a burning building, you know? It's like, and they never just have an idea, it's, I have a great idea, you know? I have a wonderful idea, you know? And you say to yourself, you know what? You don't have any ideas at all, you know? And the deal is that you don't want them thinking. And that's why I shared this morning. When you talk about what you're feeling, what you believe, and what you think, nobody cares. Absolutely nobody cares. This is not about what you feel, what you believe, and what you think. This is about what you do, the actions you take, and the actions you don't take. Period. You know? Keep that simple. I never got punched out in a bar because I said to myself, well, I think, I believe, or I feel. It was usually, I thought it was fun to take somebody's chair out from underneath them or something, you know? And after you hear a while, you realize God has a great sense of humor. God is like this whole world is a joke, and we're the punchline. And if you don't understand the punchline, you're missing out on the best joke ever. You know, God gave males their sexual peak at 18. And women theirs at 42. And he said, work with it, you know? You know he's got to have a lot of laughs, you know? A lot of laughs. And then you look at the other side of this. Weapons of mass destruction. Big phrase that's used today. Weapons of... God helped us develop weapons of mass destruction in bars. Look at the games he gave us. Shuffleboard. Two drunks at this end with heavy metal. Moving it down the board to two other drunks at the other end. Eventually, it's going to fly somewhere, you know? Or maybe that doesn't work in certain bars. For those bars, he gave them pool. Sticks. Heavy balls. Destruction. I didn't like either one of those. My personal favorite was darts. Pointy little objects. That as the night went, you carelessly threw into the night, you know, like, having absolutely no idea where they were going to land, you know. One night I'm shooting darts and there was a bathroom there, a men's bathroom with a little break front, and a guy is heading for the bathroom. I throw my weapon of mass destruction, trying to hit the board, and it goes in his leg. And my brother says to me, we need the dart. So I casually follow him into the urinal and I say, excuse me. And I take it out of his leg, which he had no knowledge it was sticking in. And we got back to the games of chance, you know. But this is the life we were living, and it was like God was having a lot of fun with us. And God has a great, as I said, he has to have a great sense of humor. One of the oldest animals in the world today is an armadillo. And they've been studying armadillos for over 125 years now. And they don't know why this is, but when armadillos have children, they always have four. They don't have one, they don't have two, they don't have three. They always have four offspring. And the offspring they have are all male or all female. Every time they have offspring, it's four, all of this or all of that. And everybody says, why? And alcoholics know. That's the way it is. What do you got to figure out? You know, like, that's the way it is. It's been that way from the beginning of time. It's going to be that way on the... What are you knowing going to change anything? You're going to load the dice for three or what? I mean, it's four. You know, that's just the way it is. And the deal is that when you're here longer, you realize that this program is so simple that people who have a lot of education miss it. Now, I'm not saying yet because they're at a disadvantage because they have education. I'm not saying that. I'm saying when they become vested in their education and they have to know the why of everything. We don't read why it works. We read how it works. You know? You look at some guys. I sponsored a psychiatrist one time. He was the dumbest person I ever met. And he used to get upset because some guy who had a third grade education had to let him in to set up the chairs. And he said, why do I have to knock at the door when he has a key? Ooh. Let me bring you up to speed. We trust him. If you had to make the coffee and analyze it at the same time, we'd go thirsty. You know, like it's just the way it is. So, you know, you watch people who sometimes they just come too loaded. And you got to kind of decrap them. And sometimes it takes a while, you know. Decrapping is not an easy thing in some people, you know. They walk around like, you know, this is my best thinking, you know. Oh, wow. We impressed. You know, they're the kind of guys, you know, it takes a while to get used to them because they always want to know why. And sometimes you just don't know why certain things happen. They just happen. You know, why am I an alcoholic? Why did this happen to me? Why did that happen to you? I tell them because they're lucky. You're lucky, you know. I told a guy the other day, I said, you make Job look like a lottery winner. You know, like, all you do is complain, you know, like, my God, you know, go on and on and on. It's that same milking a mouse, you know, like it's, you know. Stop, you know, get on with living today. This is the deal. Get on and live this moment. You know, I have guys that come up and they say, Ken, I have trouble with the third step. Do you ever have people like that? Why are you having trouble with the third step?
Because they're asking me to turn my will and my life over to the care of God.
Well, who do you think has it now, Sparky? And did you ever notice when you turn it over, you're not missing anything? You've already said that your life is unmanageable, and you're an alcoholic, and you don't know diddle. And now you're worried about giving something up that you don't have in the first place. And then you have a guy who, quote, right out of the book, you know he's reading a book, which is very good. He'll say, if I continue to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I'll become like the hole in the donut. So you casually tell him, you are the hole in the donut. And thank God you are the hole in the donut, because donuts come and go, but the hole is always there. And that hole is what connects you to whatever the universal is. You know, whatever is out there, whatever is in here, whatever you're trying to become conscious of, it's that wholeness that connects you. It's that space within you. Deep down inside each one of us is a great reality. You know, and sometimes people just miss that. They're so busy looking. I have people telling me I'm going on a journey. Life's a journey. Did you ever notice that people who are going on a life's journey are always right in the same place? Where are you going to go? This is the deal right here. This moment. And it tells you that in the big book. It says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him Thursday. You know? May you find him now. And the deal is it's the only place you can find God is right in this moment. And if you're running around looking all over the joint, you're missing. You know, you're just missing out. The thing you're looking for, you're looking with. You were sent out from the home office perfect. Somewhere along the line, you had a little bit of what we call tilt. You know? And then you thought you were something you weren't. I love people. They're going to seminars to learn methods to escape from a reality they're not in. And trying to solve problems they don't have. Most of the problems are phantom, you know? It's like, well, I've got this problem, and what is it? Well, in 2 months, or in 18 years, or when my daughter grows up. How old is she? 11 months. And, you know, can I drink at her wedding? And you got to be kidding me. You know, about 6 years ago, I decided that I wanted to do something different. So I gave away everything I own, and I went and I lived on the Indian reservation with the Navajo. And my family members were calling me saying, we think you've lost your mind. And I thanked them for the compliment. And I said, I haven't, but I'm really working on it, you know, like I'm really working. So I went over there and I met these great folks who are fighting alcoholism every single day in large numbers. And I got to meet this medicine man, and he and I used to go and take bundles of woods and go up into the mountain and light a fire and watch eagles. And Navajo love eagles. Eagles are a sacred bird. And whenever they do a business transaction, they put an eagle feather on the table. And if you violate the agreement, you're in big duty. You know, like you're in big duty. And so it's a very simple practice. And I used to ask questions like, because, you know, Thanksgiving. And I said, is Thanksgiving a big holiday out here? And the guy said, well, the first one was, Ken. We showed up with turkeys and food and stuff, and we thought it was a going away party. You know, like, we thought you were going back where you came from, you know, and we were going to get our stuff back. But once we found out you were staying, you never hear of the second Thanksgiving, you know. And so I was up there with this guy in the mountains, and we were watching them catch trout there. They have some of the best trout fishing in the San Juan River, and they use these little lures. And they do this thing called catch and release. You know, they zip it in the water and they catch these trout, good-sized trout, and then they reel them in, and then they take these little lures out and they let them go. And it's called catch and release. I'm from Brooklyn. We did catch and fillet. So I, you know, this was new to me, catch and release. In Brooklyn, if you catch something, it's yours. You know, like. And so we were watching this guy with this good-sized trout, and he was working it, and he eventually got it in. And he took the lure from its mouth, and he put it back in the water, and it swam off. And me and this medicine man were so busy watching that trout, we didn't notice this eagle coming down. And that eagle went right over that trout, dropped his talons in the water, picked it up, and took off. And this little Navajo chieftain said to me, did you ever have a day like that? I said, yeah, I have, you know. Where you think you're leaving the scene of an accident, only to find out you are the accident, you know, like, you know, you are. And you find out in life that things don't always go the way you plan. Bill was kind enough to share with us the other night some deal he did over the last few years with his wife who was passing away. And I had a chance to do that with my son. My son came home really sick. He was in full-blown AIDS. And he lived with me for 3 months and then he died. And I got to be there and see him on a daily basis go from being 190 pounds, dying at about 105 pounds. And I watched this disease just raise havoc with him. And I knew that God had a sense of humor because my ex-wife started coming to my house. I got to meet my husband-in-law. But I got to see the healing that goes on when there's something more important than the individuals involved in it. And we were not the problem. The problem was dealing with what he had to go through. And when he got down to a point where he was very, very weak and he wanted to maintain his dignity and he wanted to go to the bathroom, he would literally crawl on the floor. And I would put down comforters and pillows to make it a little bit easier for him to go across. And sometimes he would doze off and sleep a little bit while he was doing it. And as he was crawling across the floor one day, I looked, and it became very evident to me that I had crawled on the floor and lost my dignity. But here was my son crawling on the floor to maintain his dignity. So the act itself isn't what's important. It's what's bringing you to that act. And life sometimes just doesn't give you the cards you want. You know, sometimes you just don't get the cards you want. But the nice thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is what we teach you here is, although you're powerless to do anything about certain situations, you always have the opportunity to be of service to others. You know, the old saying used to be, remember, when you're down to nothing, God is up to something. You know, and that's just the way it is. When you're down to nothing, God is up to something. And I got to see a lot of somethings that God was up to. There was a lot of people, you know, sometimes you read about just one set of footprints in the sand and that poem. Well, that wasn't my poem. There was a lot of footprints in my sin because alcoholics came from all over to help me out. People came and massaged my son and did all kinds of things, brought food, and were just there. And the deal is that there's a lot of you in this room tonight. I noticed that there's at least 50 of you that have less than a year. And you're going to think that we're laughing at you during your early days of sobriety. And you're going to be absolutely right. You know? We are laughing at you. But we're not laughing at your problems. We're laughing at your solutions. You know? The logo for AA should be excess is not enough. You know? Somehow it's always about more. We need more. We got to have more. More is always in the picture. And you hear people say, I can't be happy unless this happens. Boy, that's sentencing yourself to unhappiness. Or this happened in the past and it never should have happened. There isn't a person in this room that hasn't had something happen to them that shouldn't have happened to them. But you don't make that your whole life story. You know, you get on and do the now of it. Because when you are focused on looking back at that stuff and looking ahead, anticipating stuff, you are not with God. That's why people feel this disconnect. That's why they feel this emptiness. God is in the moment. God is like a cheerleader going, let's go, let's go. And you're going, wait, 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 you know. And the deal is that you reach a point in life where you just have to realize that every moment is important. You don't have moments to wait. I have people that are afraid of all kinds of things, and most of it's never going to happen. And yet they live their whole life in fear of anticipating it. The thing that would fear me the most would be going to bed. That should make everybody in this room terribly afraid. Just going to bed at night should be the most fearful thing in the world. 98% of the people who die laying down. So going to bed should be terrifying. You know, like, whoa, you know. And if you go to bed and you sleep for 8 hours and you're 60 years old, you will have slept 20 years. And during that 20 years, some power took care of you and sustained you when you had no idea what was going on. And what Alcoholics Anonymous is about is surrendering to that power when you're awake and allowing that same power to take care of you. I love watching alcoholics. You know, sometimes it's, you see them, they're going so fast, it's like they're trying to circle one wagon. You know, like, just watch them. And you say, whoa. I mean, every time they go by, you want to yell, whoa. You know? It's like they're riding a horse and they've got thrown off. And their foot is caught in the stirrup. And you're saying, let go. Let go. And they're paying big money to some seminar to learn how to enjoy the ride. You know, like, we scratch shit that don't itch, you know. We're so into what's going to come next, you know. So the deal is tonight, just make yourself a promise that from this point on, you're just going to live in the moment as best you can. Now, it's not going to work all the time, but try to do it as much as possible. If I had you and I was your sponsor and you were having trouble, I'd get a rubber band and put it on your wrist. And every time you start to get out of it, just snap it. You know? Hey, back again. Hey, this is good. You know, I had a little drift, but I'm back now. You know? And that's the whole deal. And I love to come here for one basic reason, just what you guys are doing, laughing. You know, I know a couple of things about laughter that most people don't know. First, you cannot laugh and think at the same time. So every time you're laughing, you're getting a break from you. You know? And if you're in one of these chairs, you need the break. You know, let's face it. The other thing I know is that the more you laugh, the more endorphins you produce. And these endorphins are great for your immune system. They help build up your immune system. In fact, the American Medical Society said that sex and laughter produce the same amount of endorphins. I'm alcoholic. I'm thinking, one of my better ideas, that if you can laugh during sex, those babies are a-pumping and a-pumping and a-pumping, you know? And getting someone to laugh during sex at my age begins with disrobing, you know? Like, disrobe somebody, hey! When that happened to you, you know? Did you get a license plate number? So I know you guys have a 13-step dance. So I definitely don't want to run over on my time. You want to start picking out your targets of opportunity, you know? Don't look for Miss Wright. Look for Miss Wright now, you know? Or maybe Miss Perhaps. I don't know. And maybe they'll play some of those great songs that we used to hear when we were out doing all that stuff we did, you know? Like I'm just 2 6-packs away from loving you, you know? Throw a saddle on the stove, mama. We're riding the range tonight, you know? And I used to kiss her on the lips, but it's all over now, you know, this is it. So this is the deal, you know, if you're not laughing, you're missing out. You're just not doing stuff that's good for your health, you know. I see people sometimes that they are so angry, you know, it's like you just watch them and you say, gosh, you know, what a way to go through life. What a way to go through life when everybody else is having a good time. You know, I used to have meetings on the way to the meetings and meetings on the home, coming home from the meetings. And we had some of the best discussions going. You know, a guy would say something like, I hate my job. My job is a rotten job. I hate going there. And the other guy in the front seat would say, hey, I need a job. One day, why don't you quit and give me that job? Then the guy said, wait a second, I'm not giving my job up, you know. Did you ever notice when an alcoholic has to let go of something they don't like in the first place? It's like, wait a second, didn't you ever hear of private property? You know, so go to a lot of meetings and have a lot of laughs and know that God is doing exactly what he needs to do. And that is through each and every one of us, God is trying to become something he's never been before. And our job is not to impede him. And if you don't think you're a winner, as I mentioned this morning, when your dad ejaculated, he shot 200,000 sperm cells towards one egg. You're the winner. Come on, baby, let the good times roll, you know? And you already won. You're already here. This is good stuff, you know. Now go screw stuff up. Make us proud of you, you know, you know, go have some fun. Don't try to figure it all out. Do it. By the time you figure it out, you could have tried it 6 times, you know. It's either going to work or it's not going to work. If it works, do it more. If it doesn't work, stop immediately, you know. This is not complicated stuff. And you'll get in touch with everything. I am very, very lucky today because of everything that happened in my life, because everything that happened in my life got me right here, right now. God owes me nothing. If I get my ticket punched on the way home, you know, God owes me nothing. I had a good ride. And the deal is I want to make every day count. I want to have a lot of more days of fun, but if I don't have them, I want to take care of the ones that have been given to me. And not try to figure so much stuff out. I have even reached a point in my sobriety where I am now comfortable with dogs. I used to be petrified of dogs, you know, because they were always biting me. I was always trying to get into some place that they were trying to keep you out of. And then when you got bit, I don't take tetanus, so I'd have to go and go through all these treatments and stuff. So it was very, very... And now I'm comfortable with dogs. I was riding out in San Diego, and I looked in my rearview mirror, and I saw this Rottweiler chasing after my car, and it was about 110 degrees. So I immediately pulled over, and I lowered the window, and that dog just ran up. Now, I don't know if you know what a Rottweiler is. It's like a Doberman on steroids. You know, it's just a really big dog. And that dog just ran up alongside my car, and he was... And I looked at him. And he looked at me. And just for that moment, we were on the same wavelength. That dog and I were just right there together. He knew that I had chased after shit in my life, having no idea what I was going to do when I caught it. And he knew that I knew he was in the same place. So we kind of just eyeballed each other for a minute. I let him catch his breath. And then I said, hang in there, you know. Maybe you catch a Volkswagen or something. And that's the whole deal about being here. Being able to live life in this moment just the way it is. Not running away from it, not resisting it, and not denying it. Just saying, God, let me have this, whatever it is, and let me have the experience that's attached to it. Because that experience is going to help me. And if I constantly am worried about what I've already done and what I'm going to have to deal with, I'm missing out on the experience of God in this moment. I have no idea on how to tell you what God is. But I can tell you that I felt the presence of God in my life on more than one occasion. When my son was dying and we had to move him to the hospice, we stopped all the medication and he suddenly just opened his eyes. And he looked at me and he said, Dad, where am I and what's going on? And I told him. And he rolled his head to one side of the pillow, and he was in this world. And when he rolled his head back, he had a big smile, and he was of this world. And he said, Dad, I'm good to go. Thanks for being here. I'm good to go. And that's the way life is, getting ready every moment so that you're good to go, regardless of what else is going on around you, and not being caught up in all the distractions of stuff you have no control over. You know, our job here is to take really good care of one another because we're all just on loan. The folks that are sitting here tonight, some of them won't be back here next year. They'll have other things to do. Some of them will have sickness in the family. Some of them will be dealing with personal sickness themselves. Some might deal with death. But the bottom line is that this convention will go on and AA will continue to exist. And AA will continue to exist because it's a God thing. I have a friend that I sponsor and he just came back from Iran. He's an Iranian, a Persian. And there are now 250,000 members in AA in Iran.
Wow.
And they meet in mosque, and where they cannot go and pray together in their own religion, they go to AA meetings and they sit next to each other. And the deal is that sooner or later, as I said this morning at the spiritual meeting, somebody's going to figure out that Christians believe in one God, Muslims believe in one God, and Jews believe in one God. So we all got sent out from the same home office. You know, we are brothers and sisters. We are not enemies. And all the nonsense that surrounds this world, in God's world, is going to be shattered one moment very quickly when everybody wakes up and spiritually decides, I'm not going to play the game anymore. Because we got to take care of one another. And, you know, I used to have a friend who was a Hindu. And he'd come into my home and Harish would say, Namaste, Ken. And when he left, he would say, Namaste. And Namaste, loosely translated, means the God in me sees the God in you. And as long as the God in me sees the God in you and the God in you sees the God in me, we're going to be just fine. We're going to be just fine. Our job here is just to join the fellowship, go below decks, pick up an oar, and row. Don't go topside and try to be the captain. You know, that's when we seem to get in trouble. Just pick up an oar and row, and take really good care of one another. I want to thank you for letting me come here. Please love one another because it's the most powerful force in the world. Don't miss it. God bless you.